He was born in the summer of his 27th year. It's time for the SAFTAcast, the only podcast that talks to writers, editors, and publishers about everything except writing, editing, or publishing. I'm your host, Scott C. Episode 60 is here right now for you. Who knew we would make it to 60? Well, we didn't. But here we are, episode 6 to the 0, and what a show do we have for you, and a guest for you today. Catherine Moore is on the program, but first, before we get into that, let me tell you, as I often do, of the upcoming events of Sundress Academy for the Arts and Sundress Publications. Hey, it's been a while since we've mentioned this one. Let's talk about it right now. The award-winning Sundress Reading Series is back in action this Saturday, September 18th, in Knoxville, Tennessee, at Bar Marley, that is at 760 Stone Ave in Knoxville. The Sundress Reading Series is going to be presenting a trio of amazing authors for you: Charles Dodd White, Sybil Baker, and Randon Billings Noble. It is going to be a stunning event. That is this Saturday, from 2 to 4 p.m. at Bar Marley, as I said, 760 Stone Ave in Knoxville, Tennessee. If you do a quick search for that, I'm sure you can find the directions anywhere. On another note, hey, have you been checking out the Sundress Publications Facebook page? Maybe the Sundress Academy for the Arts Facebook page? You might have noticed that yesterday we unloaded a whole bunch of event photos onto there from various events that Sundress has been a part of over this year, including AWP in Los Angeles, and some great photos of the amazing barn-raising barbecue party that we've been talking about the last couple of episodes here. Great stuff. All you gotta do, folks, to keep up with the Sundress Academy for the Arts and Sundress Publications and everything that is going on is just type it into your search bar on Facebook and you'll find it right there, as well as the SAFTAcast. You can find us there as well, and much, much more. You can do a search for Sundress Cookbook with Darren Demery, former guest here on this program. That has come back with a vengeance, and there are some great episodes lined up. I've seen the guest list for the future episodes, and I am like, bon ami, this is gonna be good. And speaking of good, as I mentioned before, today's episode is a good one. Poet Catherine Moore is on the program, taking time out of her busy teaching schedule and life to join us for a bit here today to talk about a whole host of things. And she and I talk about our favorite words in the English language, what we collect when we go on vacations, the wonders of travel, and what languages we would both love to have implanted in our brain at a moment's notice. But those are just a few of the things we talk about. There's a lot more to come, and it's going to come in about 31 seconds. Skype's been a pain lately. They did a recent update and it's just been annoying.
Yeah, I haven't been on it in a while. I had to like update my profile information. It's like, oh, none of that is correct.
I know the feeling. Until I started doing this podcast, I totally forgot that Skype even existed.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you for being here, though. It's good to have you, and good to get in touch with you and bring you on the show. I always like to start off the show with the burning question that is on everyone's mind. And today's burning question is, what is the best or worst parenting advice you have ever heard?
Wow. It's been so long since I actually listened to any parenting advice. I'm usually giving it out now. Okay, so the best parenting advice is to not hover, to let your kids make mistakes. Unless they're going to burn the house down, really just let them go for it. They can blow up whatever they need to blow up, including just letting them have free reign in the kitchen. You know, that's how we learn, by our mistakes. So the worst advice, wow, I don't know. You know, I guess because I always sort of let my kids try new things. I know that in 2001, my son went to Australia. And no, he actually went in 2002. So there was a meeting right after 9/11, and he was in middle school at the time. It was an ambassadorship program. And a lot of people told me, you should not let him go. You should not let him go. But I really think that was a lifetime opportunity for him to see Australia and to be an ambassador. So I let him go. And I ignored all the advice of everyone else. So I guess that would be an example that would be appropriate for today.
We are recording this on the 15th anniversary, as Facebook has not let me forget.
Yes.
I have my issues with that, but not talk about it. But anyway, well, that's all good advice. Yeah. Even the worst there sounds pretty good advice. Like, ignore other advice.
Yeah, you sort of have to evaluate things based on a longer term vision. We do that with our careers, perhaps, and we do that with our own decisions, but we kind of have to do that with our kids too. And you can't immediately give in to your fear of letting them go or letting them make a mistake and deny them sort of a broader experience of life. And I guess that's kind of where both of those examples shake down to, is sort of just hovering on top of people and not letting them be who they need to be.
Have we gotten more hovering, or have we gotten more afraid as the years have gone on as a culture?
Well, definitely this political season, and this for some reason this is going really political, this interview, but it seems like fear rules. And I also teach freshman composition. So I'm seeing a lot of 18, 19-year-olds in the classroom, which I know that you teach as well. So you're kind of, you get to see these generations behind us. And I definitely think there's a little bit sense of that. I'm not sure that generation, though, is as fearful as their parents are. Sometimes there's almost a que sera, sera attitude towards the things that make us afraid. But I do know that it does seem like more and more parents seem to hover. I get parents emailing me about their kids, and I'm like, okay, they're over 18. They're supposed to email me themselves. This is not appropriate for you to still be hovering on top of this.
What happened to Generation X, which is what I'm assuming many of the parents of today are from that group, the late 70s to mid 80s start, and I classify myself among them. What happened to us? We were convinced 20 years ago slackers would rule the world, and now we're becoming this.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't really understand that either because I'm a late 60s child as far as being born, and that was the very beginning of Gen X. And I always thought that since we were able to sort of run free and barefoot and hey, get out the door, during the summertime and don't come back until the sun sets. That's kind of how we were raised. So I'm not sure what it was that happened to us that we are just as sort of hovering almost or more so than our parents' generation was to us.
I don't know. Maybe it's just something that happens when you hit your 30s or something, and just suddenly you go, okay, time to be afraid of everything.
Yeah, and I also think there's so much media coverage of things that I sort of remember there was a time period where I became aware of horrendous things happening. That probably I wouldn't have without 24-hour cable news television, which came in when I was in high school. So if you're going and looking at our communities and the people we interact with, they probably don't make us all that much afraid. But when we look at society as a whole, there's many things to latch on to be afraid of. So
Do you think it's the access then that we have with, I've thought of it this way, and I don't know if you'd agree with this, but there's no more horror or atrocity going on than there was 50 years ago. It's just that we have more access to know about it now.
yeah, that's a really good point. My friend who had just come back from New York City about a month ago, and they had gone down to the World Trade Center. And so they sort of had this moment this afternoon of contemplating things in the world. And she was with her 11 or 12-year-old, and he said, you know, there's so many horrible things happening in the world. And they were eating at the time, and it might have been Grand Central Station, but a really, really busy, busy place in New York City. And she said to him, she said, look around right now and look at how many people we can see, and everybody is doing what they need to be doing, and everybody's behaving themselves. So overwhelmingly, we're just as good as we used to be, you know? So I think we are distorted sometimes with Facebook and TV and, you know, all the negative stuff that gets press.
When it comes to negative news or whatever, do you have a secret weapon to kind of de-stress and unplug from it?
Yeah, I don't watch it. I'm infamous anti-television. And I do have to say, some of that comes from my parents. We had to actually earn TV time the way kids earn allowances when I was younger. So, you know, I could spend like my half hour that I had earned on the Brady Bunch if I wanted, but then it was over. You had to turn it off. You had to move on and pick up a book. And I sort of raised my kids that way, even in this crazy world. But, you know, when you're pumping gas at a gas station, or you're just sitting waiting for your car to get fixed, or you're at the airport, you cannot get away from the televisions they've put everywhere. Like, you literally can't get away from it sometimes.
Let's talk about the latest commercials, and here's some sport highlights. And I'm like, I'm just putting gas in my car.
I know.
I don't need this.
Yeah. And if you have a toddler in the back and it's something that you just wouldn't have your toddler watch, you're like, why? Why do I have to be exposed to all this, you know? It feels a little out of control sometimes, so I really, really don't watch a lot of television. And a lot of times what I do is I sort of follow people's opinions and reviews of shows that they like. And I'll go to TiVo or some kind of recorded service and I'll check it out. And if I like it, yeah, then I might get involved and binge watch a little bit more than I should. But I'm pretty much not, you know, going week to week, watching the same shows and just having the TV rattle on and on. I protect my time. And I think as creative people, we have to do that because the negativity will just eat your soul, I think.
I would agree. You can't, I mean, there is the argument, yeah, you can't create without some negativity, but if you let it overwhelm you.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a balance between, you know, being completely clueless and off in la-la land and then just letting it sort of eat you. And I guess I'm just at the age where I know where my balance is on that and how to sort of navigate that. But in a way, almost this new generation, they've had to sort of, you know, they've had to do that at a much younger age, come to sort of the realization of how do I balance all that?
How do I detach? How do I know what's real and what's not?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a tough question. Yeah. I think you're right. Children have to learn that lesson a lot earlier than maybe we did. Yeah.
Definitely so. And, you know, as far as like the academic writing we expect them to do, it's a huge challenge too. So
what do you find is the biggest challenge with students today in academic writing?
Well, one of the biggest challenges that I think is they seem very regimented. They seem very, and it's a little bit more than, is this going to be on the test kind of thing? But they're very almost hyper-focused on what's going to get them the good grade or what sort of discussion or thought process. Probably the same way I am with my time. Like there's a time factor, right? They're probably all saturated and they're like, I'm only going to spend time on what I need to spend time on. But one of the things that I do think, if you can get in a conversation with them and get them to have discussions, because they almost seem reluctant to talk to each other in a strange way. You know, they'll text each other all day long, but have a class discussion, you know, sometimes like pulling teeth, is they still have a great humor about them. You know, as much as they're saturated with all the negativity in the world, they're just not as jaded as some people my age group. So I really kind of like these young adults. They give me faith in the country, honestly.
I would totally agree with you. I keep looking around. I see all these think pieces now about how millennials are these bad people. I'm like, no. I look at them and I'm like, you guys are the ones pushing for marriage equality. You guys are the ones pushing for, you know, systemic racism to be shattered.
Yeah, they are. That hasn't changed. The youth energy, their positive outlook on life. You know, it's amazing given sort of the situation. And then, of course, we have the opposite, which is their parents getting scareder and pulling away and clamping down. And it's just, there's a huge gap. So I really encourage my young people and all my students, get out and vote. You just need to get out and vote because they really are kind of the energy behind changes that need to be made.
Can't do it without them. I tell my students, I'm too old to fight, guys, but I'm not old enough to not lead.
There you go. That's great.
You know, I'll give you the tools. It's your choice what to do with them, but I'm outside of that Madison Ave 18 to 35 demographic. They don't want me anymore.
Yeah, nobody cares about our opinions anymore after 35. Yeah.
Nope. Wait until I'm 55 and then start pushing the AARP stuff on me.
Yeah. And, yeah, I'm waiting for that too.
And whatever celebrity will replace Alec Trebek to tell me about life insurance. I've had the exact opposite problem in some ways. I've watched far too much television.
I mean, now some people that informs their writing. I mean, there's a lot of really good, sharp writing I see that's, you know, based or jumping off of pop culture. So I do think there's a threshold, though, when you're, you know, doing the Homer Simpson marathons and saying, oh, I'm doing research, that maybe you need to stop and you need to start writing. So.
Yeah, like, I should watch a couple of episodes of blank to kind of get the, you know, see if there's something I can pick out of there. But then I'll end up, like, you know, watching episodes and episodes of Soul Train going, whoa, I didn't realize the average white man was on here.
Yeah.
Cool.
I haven't seen Soul Train in a long time. That's funny. Yeah. Now, do you write mostly fiction or poetry?
Neither anymore. Okay. Since I became a teacher, I kind of have gone on hiatus, and I think I've published like two things in the last 3-4 years. I've just kind of fell off the map and radar.
Yeah, this year for some reason I've sort of switched, and many of the pieces I'm involved with are fiction, you know, and they're getting longer. But I do find, because the thought occurred to me, that I find I do more research, quote unquote, writing fiction than I do with poetry. So, of course, there's lots of opportunities to get sidetracked and waste time looking at Soul Train.
I think Soul Train could be a distraction for almost anything.
Yeah.
But let's move away from writing for a moment. Let's move away from politics and fear and all that. Let's take it back from the beginning here. You mentioned you were born in the late 60s, thereabouts. Where were you born?
Where do I come out? This is such an interesting thing because at the beginning of every semester, I go through this exercise where everybody talks about where they're from. And it's sort of, I'm leading the class into some questions seem very simple to answer, and yet they're not. So the simple answer is I was born in Virginia Beach, Virginia, but I have lived in nearly 20 different places. So there's nothing about Virginia Beach, Virginia that sort of defines me other than my dad was a naval officer. So I've lived overseas. I've traveled a lot. I've lived in a lot of different places. My parents are both from two other places, which I guess if I was going to claim I was from anywhere, I would say Buffalo, New York, because I have so many cousins that live there. But as you can hear in my voice, there is nothing Western New York State in my accent because I've never actually lived there.
Is there a place that you consider your hometown? Is there any place that you've lived where you're like, this is the closest thing I could claim to a hometown for me?
I don't know. To be honest, probably not. My kids were both born in Tallahassee, Florida, and I spent the largest spans of time there. So in a way I could say Tallahassee, Florida, but most of the time I lived there, I was trying to get out of Florida. So it's a real love-hate relationship I have with Florida.
I think every resident of the state feels the exact same way.
Exactly. Especially right about now when August is just like reaching its ugly hand into September and is so oppressively hot. And then you have the hurricanes blow through. I'm definitely not sort of genetically geared towards that kind of heat. So my DNA says, no, I don't like Florida. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, Sometimes I moved every 6 months, so it's really hard for me to say I have a hometown. And a lot of times we were in naval housing, so I don't really even have a house that's in my mind as my childhood home. It's a bit vagabond, and it's hard for people to sort of understand that. But I'm very attached to my nuclear family. Like, my brothers are it. If I have a hometown, it's when my brothers get together, no matter where we are.
How many brothers do you have?
I have three brothers.
Older or younger than you?
Kind of a mixed bag. I'm the second in line.
But you're close and tight with them then.
Well, they're brothers, so
As close as brothers and sisters could be.
yeah, I mean, they're not strange because my fiance says, it's you guys don't call each other and what have you, and we do, but we don't, in the way that he thinks my brothers would call me. It's usually like a family emergency if the phone's ringing. But when we get together, we're right back to being the tight little knit group that, kind of took care of each other through all the different moves that we had to make. And we have all our inside jokes and secrets. And, we pretty much go back to being 10 years old when we're together. So,
You pick up right where you left off from last time.
yeah. It's
But
pretty sad, actually.
no, I think that's as great. Being an only child, I don't have that experience to draw on, so I think it's awesome. But traveling around and everything, do you feel like you still have a vagabond, a nomad spirit about you?
I definitely do now. I've moved into the Nashville area and was very, very surprised how much I like it because to me, I was like, Nashville, like country music. I don't know if I want to live there. But of course, it's much bigger than that. There's all kinds of music and all kind of art. And it's got such a fantastic writing community here in Nashville and in Tennessee that I've just been, astounded happily. So if there was someplace I would stake out for a while, I would probably stake out here. But at the same time, as we look to the future, if that means we got to pack up and move, that's what we have to do.
So it's like Nashville's become a home base kind of thing, but you're not averse to traveling.
Oh no. I would even live overseas, but my fiance probably wouldn't go with me, so that's kind of off the list of things to do, but
Yeah, kind of a deal breaker then.
yeah, kind of a deal breaker.
If you could live overseas right now, where would you want to be?
I would move to Lisbon, Portugal.
Interesting choice. Why Lisbon?
I went there several years ago in a writing conference, and I just fell in love with it. And I've been to Europe before, and people told me, if you like Paris and you like the European vibe and Madrid, you're really going to like Lisbon. People kept telling me that. Well, they were absolutely right. It's like it's sort of like being in Tuscany, Italy. The climate is very Mediterranean, very nice, very Southern California. The food is fantastic. It's all seafood. It's almost like being in Florida with rolling hills, low humidity, and great seafood. And I'm like, this is wonderful. And the people there, more so than any other sort of big city in Europe, they really like Americans. They're just very friendly and open, very accommodating. Plus, from what I understand, even though I was just a visitor and thought it was pretty reasonably priced, it's like the least expensive capital of Europe to live in. Yeah. People like want to pick up and move to Costa Rica, which to me sounds a lot like Florida, even hotter. I want to pick up and move to Lisbon, Portugal, so because then I can beat the humidity.
I totally relate to that. I'm in South Florida, and so many people down here are like, "Oh, I can't wait to go on this cruise to the Caribbean." I'm like, "Why? You live in South Florida. You live in the tropics."
Yeah, what's up with that? I had a friend that's all she wanted to do was go on a cruise to the Caribbean. And then she said, oh, or we could go to Hawaii. And I thought, well, at least now we're getting into a slightly different climate. But I always kind of wanted to go to Alaska when I lived in Florida. I still want to go to Alaska.
Is Alaska the only place that's like on a hit list for you, or are there other places as well?
I really would love to go to New Zealand. If we're talking about big places, go to New Zealand. I haven't been to Greece, so that's definitely on my list. And so much of the United States, quite honestly, I have seen. I know it's sad to say that, but we lived in all these different places, and my mom would like draw a circle around, and we would like see everything we could possibly drive to. And I'd like to see the Great Wall of China. I lived in the Philippines as a child during that 1960s, late 60s period. And I'd like to revisit the Philippines, although it's very dicey and dangerous right now to do that. So that's sort of a back burner thing is to go to China and to go back to the Philippines.
Visit East Asia a little more
Yeah.
in depth as an
Yeah,
adult.
exactly. Right.
Man, I feel so envious sometimes talking on this show because I feel like I have not traveled far. I know I have, but not out of the country really, except Canada. So I've really got to do more traveling, I think.
Well, it's good to do it when it's affordable. Sometimes it's not. So I'm always looking for schemes and ways to make it affordable, Maybe we could get teaching gigs overseas. See, that was my whole idea about getting a job overseas.
Yeah, so like a sabbatical for 6 months to Lisbon.
Yeah, that would be great.
I want to do some writing in Hamburg, in Germany.
Yeah, right. The problem is you have to come up with some kind of proposal, though, usually for those kinds of grants.
Let me think. I'd like to do a book based around the Beatles' early years in Hamburg.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good idea.
George Harrison's 15 years old and they sneak him into bars. Maybe the pop culture background could help me after all. Do you still do a lot of traveling throughout the year?
I try to, with the teaching schedule being what it is, you're kind of locked in. I still have the youngest child is in middle school now, so there's that. So it's really kind of slowed down a bit on that.
Have you passed that love of travel and exploration onto your kids?
Yeah, my son just graduated from FSU and he took off for a month and he went back to Spain. When I went to Portugal, they came with me and then they took off to Spain to visit some friends. And he stayed with a friend of his in Spain. Then they decided while they're there, hey, there's this cheap flight to Rome. So they went to Rome for a weekend. And then after they did Spain, they went down into Morocco. Now that did kind of make me a little nervous. But he's like, once they hit 25, you really can't tell them what to do anymore. But they took a safari through the desert, on camels and whatnot. So, yeah, it's definitely a bug that I have transferred onto my children.
I'm just thinking, it's like, yeah, we just got this cheap flight to Rome. We're going to go there for the weekend.
Yeah, can you? But they do that. And he flew, and I know the airlines. I mean, it's like you almost have to pay to go to the bathroom. They're so cheap. And it's Ryanair, but man, you can get some cheap flights on Ryanair. You just have to put up with the airlines.
Like I'm just thinking, here in America, because, it makes total sense with Europe because it's so much smaller and so more dense than the United States. So massive.
Yeah.
We talk about like, oh, just a commuter flight from San Francisco to Los Angeles. Over there, it's, yeah, we're going to fly from London to Rome for the weekend.
Yeah, that's
And it's,
exactly what it's like.
we'll be back by dinner on Sunday night, no problem.
Yeah, it's amazing, isn't it? It's just really incredible. We took off from Lisbon and we went to Madrid for the weekend. It was like 45 minutes in the air total from the airport there to the airport there and on the subway.
It's got to be mind-blowing. Because Americans, we're weird. We don't have a very good timeline to work with. For us, it's I think Henry Rollins puts it as, for us, we'll go to some museum and be like, well, this happened 50 years ago. And we'll be like, whoa, 50 years? And meanwhile, in Europe, it's like, this building is over 500 years old. And you're like, what?
I did the what's it called? Airbnb, and I rented an apartment while I was in Lisbon, because we had enough people, it was more affordable than doing a hotel. And this building that we were in was in the old part of the city, and I swear it was probably built in the Middle Ages. It was like, wow, this thing feels like it's going to fall apart. But meanwhile, she had like high speed Wi-Fi in there and all this other stuff. a big screen TV so we could watch the World Cup soccer championship. So it's very different over there. It's a very big mix of the high and low and the new and the old. And I do know people who have come over here to tour the United States, and they're sort of, they have 2 weeks to do the United States, and they get to do like one or two states, and they're like bummed because the US is so big, there's no way you could fit it in 2 weeks.
Oh, a great saying I remember about how Americans measure, Europeans measure things in years. We measure things in miles. Let's say you're in Europe, and it's just like, oh, a 4-hour drive will bring you across two countries. And we're like, a 4-hour drive will barely get me across the state of Florida.
Right, exactly. 4 hours from now, I don't know. It might take that long to go lengthwise through Tennessee to get from the mountains over to Memphis, So,
Yeah,
and we're a small state, so.
I don't know what the distance, the time would be from, say, Bristol, Tennessee, all the way over to Memphis. I don't know what the I, it's been last time I was did West Tennessee was I think 2003, so it's been a while.
Yeah, I went to Memphis. That was one of my bucket list things while I'm here in Tennessee this past summer, and it took us about 3 hours. So if you're coming from the mountains, you could be pushing 4 hours, yeah, easily.
I was so amazed when I went to Memphis that here's Memphis, this metropolitan. As soon as you cross the bridge, it becomes tidal flatland with
Yeah, it's
almost.
all wetlands over there in that bend of the river up there. I was like, wow, these are just like you can get an airboat and float around up here.
It's like here's a metropolitan city. You go across, and it's like here's a gas station. And it's like it's such a drastic shift. It's like wow, stunning. But that's not dumping on Arkansas. I've been to Arkansas, and there's some stuff to love in Arkansas.
Is there? I just drove across there because I wanted to say I've been in Arkansas, but I have heard it's pretty.
I recommend Hot Springs, Arkansas. It's a fun place. It's a little expensive because it's a bit of a touristy place, but it's a nice little town.
Okay, a friend of mine's going to a writer's retreat there, so I'll find out what that's about.
Natural springs making for jacuzzis in the mountains. I'm okay with this.
Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
So you obviously traveling is one of your biggest passions, I'm guessing.
Yeah, I would have to say that's true.
What else is up there? Like when you go traveling, do you collect a lot of souvenirs from your trip, or do you collect just photographs and memories?
I try not to do too much in the way of souvenirs. If there's something specifically I know that an area is known for, I'll do that. Pre-9/11, before we had a whole bunch of security on airplanes, you could just go over and like gather up all the beer and wine you want and stuff it in your carry-on, and bring it onto the plane, no problem. So I did kind of collect those kinds of things when I used to travel, but that's sort of gone by the wayside. And when I'm traveling, I really like to try that local flavor, the food. Sort of go to the less touristy things. and one of the other things that I collect, and it sounds kind of weird, but probably not because you're a writer, so I'm speaking to a writer, is I'd like to collect phrases that are used by other languages. And I have a poem that's in a collection that's going to be coming out this fall. And when I read it, I explain this to people that the title of the poem came from this expression that's in the Portuguese, which is when somebody's putting their foot in their mouth, which is our expression, and you want them to shut up, you tell them to swallow a frog. And so I really love these sort of idioms that are out there because when we use our own idioms, they sound very cliche and tired, but when you use one that you picked up from another culture, it's interesting, It's like found poetry everywhere. If you're listening for the language and seeing how they use their language and how when it translates, but it doesn't translate directly, like what the wonderful things that happen there, So that's kind of interesting. And I travel with a little journal and I'm always writing down bits and pieces of weird things. So I'm known for taking pictures of signs because there's something on there that I think language-wise is really interesting. And everybody else is, oh, look at the tree. And I mean, the tree is beautiful, but I tend to take document in a very different way, I think.
But it's not documenting in like, oh, this is obviously bad grammar. This is like, this is great.
Yeah, exactly. Or this for some reason speaks to me, so I'm going to, do that.
There's a pretty famous photo on the internet, I think, in the just floating around is, I think it's like a public park sign in China that just says, "Be careful, grass is sleeping."
That's wonderful.
It's like, wow. It just means like, don't step on the grass, please. It's sleeping. Wow. Never thought of that. Cool. Yeah, there's something about us writers, we're always on the lookout for that kind of thing.
Yeah, and I wish I knew a language well enough to do translation, speaking of which, I don't. I just sort of delight in it in sort of a, non-professional kind of way.
Is there a language that you would love to learn if you had the ability to instantaneously download the knowledge for it?
Well, it might be helpful to know Portuguese if I move to Portugal. That would probably be a good call. I took many years of French. And I can operate in France, particularly reading, better than any other language. I think I've reached that saturation point in my brain where, as much as I go back to it, I seem to be just reminding myself of stuff I already know, and I can't make any headway with learning anything new in the language.
So Portuguese then.
Portuguese, yeah, why not?
It could be useful, yeah,
Yeah.
definitely. There, Brazil and a few other places would be great for.
Yeah, all the great countries of the world, they say. Yeah,
I would learn Gaelic, I think. The
now
classic
I've
Gaelic.
actually tried to do that, and I don't know. There's something about maybe because I know enough French that Portuguese, is sort of this blend of Spanish and French, something I'm familiar with. The Gaelic, when I approach it, and that would be cool to learn Gaelic, and that is my ancestry. 95% of me is from the west coast of Ireland. It is so different. It's like learning Middle German or something. I'm like, wow.
I wanted just so I could actually sing along correctly to the Irish Gaelic music that I enjoy listening to.
Right, exactly. Through the translation, you might think, well, these songs are absolutely ridiculous.
Many of them are at times.
Yeah, we're singing about seaweed. That seems like a little bit.
But it sounds great.
It does sound great. It's beautiful to hear it in their voices too. Yeah.
That's the beauty of other languages. Just sounds better. I use that actually when I teach poetry. Is one of the first lessons I explain is I think the concept comes out of Kenneth Koch talking about the word red and roja and which sounds better, and the idea of sonics. So I use, here's the word night and here's the word noche. Which one sounds more dark, more intense?
Right. It lives at a phonetic level. And it's also sometimes the things that are less familiar to us. The words we wouldn't type up in a memo that sort of resonate and make it more interesting because it's a sound we don't always hear.
Yeah, I hate to use the word here, but exotic almost.
Yeah, almost. Yeah. And many of those are just even English words. I have sometimes where the students raise their hand, they say, "Is that an actual word?" Because I don't dumb my language down when I speak to them, whether they're 5 or they're 18. And that always like makes me laugh. I'm like, "Yes, it is a real word, and you are assigned to look it up."
Do you have a favorite word in English? Is there a word that you absolutely love?
I have so many favorite words. It's ridiculous. I was looking at something the other day, and this again sounds silly, but it was Mr. Frumble. I don't know if you remember that from the Richard Scarry's books. And I was like, I love that word frumble. I don't know why. I like words that sound like the person or sound like the object or sound like the thing that you're describing, That always sort of intrigues me.
Yeah, now that I think of it, because it's football season, today's the first day of the NFL season, first Sunday of the NFL, and I'm thinking of the word fumble, and I'm like, that describes exactly what happens.
Yeah, but he's frumble. He's also frumpy, because his Mr. Frumble, his like shirt is often untied, and his poor, he just always looks like a mess. So I'm like, that's such a great name, Mr. Frumble.
And frumpy is also a great word, too.
Yeah, frumpy. Now I think these are Germanic words, though. I don't think they're Latin-based words. So sometimes just going with the real guttural German word to me seems less academic almost. It seems like more of our academic words and, the polysyllabic words that we use tend to be Latinate. And so just getting into some good old English, Germanic, guttural words is kind of cool sometimes, particularly as a poet.
Getting almost not a base language, not dumbing it down, just more visceral.
Yeah, visceral. That's exactly it. Now, I think visceral is a Latinate word, but yes, we're talking about visceral.
I was just thinking, I think my favorite word is Latinate, and that is antediluvian.
Ooh.
Always love that word, the musicality of it.
It sounds a little shady, doesn't it? Criminal.
Yeah, antediluvian. Students
Anti
are.
anything is pretty good, though. It's sort of like you're already setting it up like what I'm talking about is the opposite of what I'm talking about.
The antechamber,
Yeah.
ante up. Yeah, well, that's a phrase, not a word. But anyway, we could discuss semantics all we want.
Yeah, right. Waste a lot of time doing that.
I find semantics kind of fascinating, though.
I do. One of my favorite podcasts is the Away with Words, the roots and the stories behind how these words even came into fruition. So,
The etymology is fascinating too.
yeah, my poor kids, they had to listen to that stuff on the radio when I got stuck in the car for a long time.
I mean, they could be words that you think of every day, and yet you're like, where did we co- oh, how did that become part of the lexicon?
Yeah. Like there's this jam that they sell down here downtown at one of the little honey shops or what have you, and it's pawpaw jam. And it's like, how do these things get named pawpaw? How did that fruit get named pawpaw? I'm endlessly fascinated with the stories behind that stuff.
Where did cool come from? How did that become the defining marker for a thing that is pleasing to you?
Right. Or when I was growing up, and some of the area I lived in was New England, it was wicked. And then it was wicked cool. Wicked cool. You couldn't beat wicked cool. That was like the ultimate.
That kind of goes into the 80s. That becomes more national then, because I remember saying that a lot as a kid in the early 80s and 90s.
Yeah, I think it got picked up and kind of spread around. It's the same way that, what was it? Totally Awesome came out of California and sort of spread around.
And then it dies off and then resurges. As long as it's own beast.
It is its own beast.
Yeah.
One of the kids said something to me the other day, and I said, "Oh, is that a compliment?" Because I just didn't understand I had not heard that particular word before. And they're like, "Oh yeah, okay, good."
Yeah, I've messed with my students sometimes because I tell them, surely, when you're talking about formal tone, you don't use slang in your essays. And my students are like, why not? And I'm so, because you don't know your audience. They may not know what YOLO means. And I go, how many of you still say that even? That was like 3 years ago. And they're like, nobody. I'm like, yeah, none of you use gag me with a spoon or marv out.
Yeah. And
That's my.
some things are completely generational, like things I would not pick up, and then other things I cannot get to leave my spoken language. I can't stop saying awesome. I'll never be able to do that. To not say awesome or
Yeah, I don't think I'll ever get bitchin' out of my system.
Yeah, I mean there's just something about the age, something gets burned into your mind and it just becomes your crutch word. You just use it when you're falling back to language you don't want to spend too much time thinking about. You just want to roll with it.
You can pry my words from my cold, dead hands.
Exactly.
Maybe that's one of the benefits of getting older. I don't know. I'm still trying to find them.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't help you with that.
I mean, I've got a few, but there's also the weird things such as like, why do I have hair growing out of my ear now?
Yeah, I saw a poem or something recently, and it was absolutely hilarious. And it was talking about random hair growth. I was like, that is so, it was brilliantly done, but now I can't remember who did it. So I don't know why I'm bringing it up.
We might have to search it out and put a link up for it after the show airs to let people know about it, because I'm always interested in stuff like that. I love it when we take in poetry the idea of taking something that almost not taboo, but something we're all aware of in one way or another, and then talk about it, bring it to the light.
Right, because you have such a built-in audience of people who would say, I totally know what you're saying, even though I'm not going to tell anybody I actually read this and laughed at it, which I just did on the air with you, but
One of the pieces I'm teaching this semester is for Ode to Granny Panties.
it almost sounds familiar, like I've read it before. I'm always looking at, see, I don't write a lot of humor in my poetry. But I enjoy it, and I tend to write a lot of humor in my fiction. It's almost as if I go the opposite way, poetry being like the dark me and the fiction being the funny me.
It's tough to do humor in poetry.
It is. It can go very, very wrong. And you know this from listening to people get up and have open mic sessions, that stuff that they thought was funny or was funny to them, sort of like, it's almost watching a stand-up comic when nobody's laughing, you know. It's very awkward.
It's because it's not stand up, but people think it is.
Yeah. Well, you know, if you're doing a funny poem, it kind of is. You've almost like thrown yourself into that category. And so then you have to be really good at delivery, which is a whole nother gig.
And there better be substance behind it. I think you can do jokes in poetry. Yeah, you can do them. You can have humor, but it's got to be tempered with something more.
Right. George Carlin comes to mind as somebody who was always doing something that was funny and edgy, but it underneath it was something profound he was trying to get you to think about.
The truth teller comic.
Yeah.
George Carlin, Richard Pryor, who's contemporary that does it? Key and Peele, I feel like they do it as well. Leslie Jones, to a degree. Tig Notaro, they're the modern poets in a way.
Yeah, in a way. And honestly, I think that part of it, which is both serious and humorous at the same time, we really need that in a world where, you know, things seem very serious. To be able to crack up and laugh about stuff. It's an emotion that, you know, sort of gets relegated to, okay, now we're doing comedy because we're watching a comedy movie. And in my family, this big Irish family that I live in, you know, Comedy Central was the dinner table. Like there were things going down or being said. You could barely get your food down sometimes because we laugh so hard when we all get together. So it's not sort of like a relegated thing, like, okay, so now we're going to have the time where we watch a funny movie because it's funny time, you know? So
Yeah,
I deeply appreciate the serious and the funny at the same moment. Not everybody does, though, because when I've done that myself, in particular, I'm thinking about a poem that I written because I'm a cancer survivor. Sometimes I write about being ill. And somebody took issue and just lambasted me and said, cancer is not funny. I said, no, it's not funny. But when a funny person gets cancer, they can act kind of funny. Like it doesn't take your personality away just because you're sick.
and if you can't find some humor in it, then there's a problem.
Yeah, you're not living the human experience at that point because if part of how you define yourself is, you know, I have to laugh every day or I'm not living. Yeah, don't let anything take that away from you.
Cancer or whatever disease,
Whatever.
find a way to joke about it.
Yeah.
Don't let somebody else joke about it for you, though. No, I
No,
have
I think
rights.
that was the issue, is this person was very close to a very serious situation at the time. And I just very carefully stepped away from that. You know, I don't have to force that on them. Where they were at that moment, it had to be serious because they were in the fight, man. So I respected that and just, and we didn't get into it, but
Might have been very raw for them at that moment.
yeah, exactly. And I can respect it. I just sort of deal with stress a little differently. And I feel like if I can laugh it off or I can make a joke out of it, then it doesn't have the power over me that it thinks it does.
It's the way Mel Brooks talked about Hitler, actually. Somebody asked him, was like, why do you use Hitler so much, being that you're Jewish? And he said, because when you laugh at him, you take away his power over you.
Yeah. And actually, now that you said that, you reminded me of this one comedian. And again, given my age, I can't come up with this name for some reason. But he is Iraqi American. And he does this bit in this skit, and it's about being Muslim in America, and it's about crazy fanaticism and falsely perceived crazy fanaticism. So there's this whole sort of almost uncomfortable, like taking you to that edge of uncomfortable political commentary in it. But at the same time, it's really, really funny. He's really funny. And his family sounds a lot like mine as far as what they joke about and the dark humor. So
Families are the same no matter where you go.
I know. They just keep reproducing all over the globe.
Well, just to return it back almost full circle here, is like I don't really want to go on a cruise, but I have said that if I ever have a terminal illness and I'm they're like, you have 6 months, you can either go through treatment or go on a cruise. I'd be like, I'm going to take a cruise, and then I'm going to ask the captain if I can drive the boat. Because what are they going to do? I'm dying. Can I drive the boat? Sure. Thank you.
Yeah.
Cool. But okay, we're getting a little morbid here now. That's okay. But before, when I'm looking at our clock, I'm like, wow, the time has flown by, Catherine.
Yeah, it
This
has.
is we have covered a lot of ground and talked about many things and then haven't even touched on some other things, I'm sure. But before we wrap this up, before we let you go, you mentioned you got some work coming out this fall.
Yes, I have a collection coming out from Dancing Girl Press, and it's called Wetlands. And if I had to describe it to you, it goes right back to how I feel about Florida. It's very wet, it's dark, it's creepy, you don't know what's under the water, you don't know where the ground ends, and that sort of coupled with a bunch of relationship things. So yeah, sort of Southern Gothic thing.
And
In poultry.
that's coming out from Dancing Girl Press in next month or so.
I don't have the set date
But
for it.
definitely this fourth quarter
Definitely this
here.
fall, yes, before
Excellent.
Christmas.
We'll keep an eye out for that. And of course, you have a couple more out that have been out for a while now.
I do. I have one that's called 921B Elysian Fields Avenue, Return to Sender. And it's a series of letter poems that tell a story. And this one is based in New Orleans, where I lived. I went to college. I left at 18 and went to Sin City. And so there's a lot of sort of 80s New Orleans stuff in here, late 80s. And it's sort of a little bit mysterious, something going on there that's you have to figure out by reading the letters. And the first one's a little more traditional. It was published in 2014 by Finishing Line Press, and it's a collection of narrative poems.
Awesome. Where can the folks find you online? They want to check you out, check some of your work out, or get to know you a little bit beyond the show.
I don't do the website thing because I'm just too pressed for time, and I tweet a lot. So mostly the writer me is on Twitter. And that is at Cat Poetic, is where I tweet out and just mainly just writing things I like, or things going on with me, or things going on with writers that I like to follow. That's probably the best way to find me. And I will be reading in December over in Knoxville with the Sundress or the SAFTA reading series.
Kick ass. Well, maybe we can work our way, depending when the semester's over, we might see you there. Indeed.
Be
Well,
great.
Catherine, thank you for coming on the program today.
Okay, thank you very
It was a
much.
pleasure having you, and feel free to come back anytime and tell us more travel stories.
Okay, I'll dig up a few more. Okay,
Excellent. We'll talk to you soon then.
thanks. Bye.
The SAFTA Cast is a production of the Sundress Academy for the Arts. For episodes and more, visit saftacast.com. Until we talk again, this is your host, Scott C., signing off.